Yeah, well, I think on that auspicious note, why don't I turn it open and let some folks from the audience ask you questions?
Oh, yeah, any questions? Somebody.
How aware and influenced were you guys by like the Wrecking Crew, you know, the guys in LA, Tommy Tedesco, yeah, and Hal Blaine? Were you listening to them?
Well, it's the Wrecking Crew, you know, Hal Blaine and all that team always in Hollywood doing this stuff. Well, we were influenced in as much as that we listened to American records, and they were probably influenced by listening to English records, but I don't think we heard any of their stuff because we didn't particularly know what gear, what records they were on anyway. It's only they knew, and they called.
You guys were like the same thing. Right?
I know it was.
They were the West Coast version of what you guys did.
Yeah, obviously what they did and the sounds they got and the approach they got to the music was influenced us, but I think, you know, but the English and the British music influenced them. And in fact, I think Hal Blaine writes in his book somewhere about how his playing was influenced by the English and the European approach to pop music, you know, which was quite strong, was quite individual.
You
know?
Did you read the For Guitar Players Only, the Tommy Tedesco book?
No, I haven't read Tommy. In fact, I've met Tommy Tedesco, but
I've got to read it. It's hilarious. He has all the stories, you know, all the studio stories.
Oh, yeah.
Falling asleep during, you know, and having to snore, the orchestra stopped and sleeping on the couch and started snoring. And with the rest, it's filled with just.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of. We've got some funny stories.
I'm sure you do.
I must read Tommy Tedesco's book, yeah. He was a great guitar. Didn't he put himself down as doing the most recordings of any guitarist in the world or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But he was a good player, good player.
What you said, isn't
it? Another song.
Oh.
Andy, was P.S. I Love You recorded at the same time as Love Me Do and Please Please Me?
Was which?
P.S. I Love You?
Yes.
And that's you, right?
On the same session.
Yeah, and that's you, right?
Yeah.
I thought so.
The two versions of it, though.
Yeah. That one's not always identified with you as playing the drums. Love Me Do version 3 is, but I thought that was you because I thought it was at the same session and I heard that before.
Right. The one that's on the first album is the one I did.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Did you guys have a certain genre of music that you like playing more so than others?
Certain type of music that we like, certain genre of music that we like playing.
Not really. I don't like playing any kind of music. No.
And whether you know, Andy is one of the world's greatest Scottish, kilt band drummers.
I started playing drums in the Boy Scouts. Our scout troop formed a pipe band. And that's when I started drumming, you know, so I was kind of schooled in the Scottish technique before I ever went to London.
He teaches four pipe bands in America. They fly all over the place. So
some of them aren't very good, but solid.
But they're better for you, aren't they?
Yeah.
But no, I think I just like music, you know, and actually I've kind of turned onto country music recently. Kind of makes sense. And what's the old gag where the guy played a country music record backwards and the guy got his girl back and he got his truck back? it just reminded me of it. But I like sort of cool jazz and stuff like that. Listen to all stuff. You know, I write a lot of background music which covers all type from Indian to polka to God knows what. So I have to integrate myself into his various genres, you know. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, you were saying that you got paid hourly. Did you ever get like a bonus if like the song was in?
Well, not hourly, it was by the session. It was wrong there, Gordon. You get paid by a 3-hour session. Very seldom, very seldom. I remember there was one guy who came from Italy and I was doing some overdubs on some tracks that he brought to Italy and I was paid a session wage, which I don't know was about 70 $20 back then. And this guy used to give me £20 as a tip, and I think that's about the only tip I've ever had, you know. But apart from under a Scotchman's kilt. But I never really had a tip. No. Not, it's, yeah, I know what you're thinking, like a day laborer when you go in and move somebody's house and they give you a little bit.
Well, not only that, I mean, like, if you worked on like a song that like hit it big, would they ever say, hey, thanks, you know, like,
no.
But they would give you another gig if you were on.
But they'd give you another gig, but then if it got really big and then you start and they thought, well, maybe we've got to pay this guy, it's kind of Vic Who? You know, no, there was none of that. That's just why we are now kind of fighting against the sort of bureaucracy and corporate world to try and get some of the money which we should have had. We didn't find out until a few years ago that every time a record is broadcast, some money is paid to an organization that was supposed to pay it to the musicians, you know, it's PPR, in England, going through hell with that. And so the PPR organization gave it to the British Musicians Union because they thought they knew who was on the records, but the Musicians Union made a point of not finding out who was on the records, and they kept the money and bought new houses and pensions and new cars and shit. And so we're trying to get our just due. In fact, I created such a stink in the UK that a government body called the Monopolies and Mergers Committee moved in and said, just a minute, these guys should be getting it. And we have some nice checks at some times, you know, but which hopefully will continue. Yes, sir?
Oh. I was interested in your educational background. Were you private lessons or did you go to an art school?
I started on piano. I got to quite a good grade on the piano. I started when I was about six or seven. And when it got to 14, my father had a dance band and he played piano and other people. And I wanted to be in the band, so the only instrument that wasn't there was the guitar. So my father's friend bought a guitar home from his work that he didn't want it, and that's it. So I put a tank commander's microphone, you know, those throat mics on the end of the machine head, and played it through my father's radio, and that was the first electric guitar. Did you read Mo Foster's book? No, that's quite, you should read it. In England it's called, no, in here it's called
Play Like Elvis.
Play Like Elvis. And in England it's called 17 Watts, which refers to the first amplifier, guitar amplifier. And in it, he sort of relates some. That's a good book to get with Mo Foster's Play Like Elvis, yeah. But that's a good point. Yeah. So.
You had mentioned about five guitarists that were session men that were contemporaries.
More than five, yeah.
And Jimmy Page is one of them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for me, you know, he goes and joins the Yardbirds, or, you know, and Led Zeppelin and Millions and all that. Did you court the idea of either one of you of starting a group by seeing that you're making these people, but you know, trying your own hand at it?
Some of the guys did. Actually, it's this interesting thing. I was on the actual session because he had to, when he told Charlie Katz, who was a big contractor in England, the guy. Jimmy told Charlie Katz's wife that he wouldn't be able to do any more sessions because he was going and rehearsing with Led Zeppelin. It wasn't Led Zeppelin, they hadn't thought of the name then. And Charlie Katz came over, and I remember Jimmy was there and I was sat here, and Charlie Katz came over and he says, Jimmy, what's this about you forming a group? So Jimmy said, yes, you know, very big sort of guy, Jimmy, you know. And he said, you sure? He said, yes. I think I'm making a big mistake. Jimmy was wonderful. Lived with his parents. And at the end of each session, we used to get these little brown packets of money. Do you remember?
Mm.
And Jim never knew what to do with them. And he said, well, what am I doing with these records? So I said, well, put them in the bank. He said, no, I don't want people to know I'm earning money. So, and he had, like, must have piles of these envelopes under his bed. Because he was living with his parents, but not a bit of money, you know, so. And now he's got a bigger problem. Tough, huh?
Yeah.
But that's interesting. There was a few of the guys called, they started Blue Mink, for example, and Sky, there's another group called Sky. And they sort of went up and went down again, but instrumental stuff, but not as big as Led Zeppelin and stuff.
And then the likes of Johnny McLaughlin.
Well, Johnny McLaughlin, yeah, I knew Johnny McLaughlin very, very well, and we used to work together. It was a, you see, when I say I've worked with these people, and Andy says he does, it was a lot of work. And there's a few guitar players, for example, that could read, and very few drummers that were actually any good that could read as well. So he was permanently moving around in this group, and John McLaughlin was, and he wasn't very good at sessions because he didn't sort of concentrate and didn't want to be there, you know.
You usually had him on a rhythm guitar.
Yeah, he was on rhythm guitar, and he was a little bit chunky on rhythm guitar, but he would be playing. I've often said that if they recorded, kept his mic open, because he was doing all this bit, when he wasn't being recorded, and they could have made like 10 albums out of his ooblets, you know, when he wasn't being recorded, because he was a fantastic guitar player. A fantastic solo guitar player. He wasn't too good actually in a band as a rhythm section. That might my take on it anyway. You were aware of him. Some guitar players and some drummers you played with, and you didn't even know they were there. But people like John, you know, used to kind of sort of finish up with a knee aching. But he was a fantastic guitar player. But horses for courses. It's a good guy. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
It sounds like you were so incredibly busy, so overwhelmed that maybe you weren't able ever to step back. I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was incredibly difficult until you heard a song hit number one or something like that to say, wow, things are changing. I was a part of it. But I wonder, were there moments of reflection where you realized the music we're making now is different from what they were doing then? That we're making 5 years, you know, on is different than what we were doing. Were you aware of the revolution of the change that was happening in the music world as you were doing it?
Yes, I suppose so, because a different style of music took over, but I wasn't that aware that it was changing dramatically or how it was changing, really. It was just work, you know, and it sounds very mundane to say that, but it just, first of all, everybody got the chance to listen to the radio, and the only time you knew when you that there was a hit record going on was when you actually did a TV, and they would say, and here's Fred Bloggs, the number one, you know, you think, hey, I was on that, I say, you know, and that's when you realise what was happening, but it just sort of evolved, you know, like you do, you change, your playing adapts to what was needed, and that's a good question. I hadn't thought about that, but now I'll step back and look, but it's too late. No, it's not too late, but I mean, you know, to change anything, we just went with the flow, and you just played what you had to play, and the arrangers were listening to it, and you actually adapted your playing to what the arrangers wanted, or they'd say, hey, listen to this latest recording from America. In fact, we're down to this. Andrew Lou Goldham, who managed the Stones, came across to America. This is what used to go on. Came across to America, and he got a little famous group like the 3 Degrees or something. Not exactly them. Took the recording back to England. He put a tambourine on it and released it as an English group. And he made a lot of money from that. That gave him the money to do the Stones. You know, it's funny how things work. It's even a crook in America, though. It really was, but still. Yes, sir.
When you were doing recordings, let's say in the early 60s, those Beatles recordings or whatever, how many tracks would you do on those? Were the vocals being done at the same time you were playing? Did they come in later and sing the vocal parts?
You don't have to do the talking, Andy. Back in the 60s, early 60s, we used to record what was called compatible stereo, which means it was, at one time, it was just like mono. Then we went to compatible stereo, which means you could play mono or stereo. And then the two-track became separated. We used to put the band on one, then the vocals, then the big four-track came in, and that was like drums and things and all this. But those 60s, maximum four tracks. And then they used to do the singer, put the singer on again. Because the union allowed us, the musicians' union allowed us to do four backing tracks. This is whistling a bit, Jesse. Four backing tracks, or we could do up to 20 minutes of music with the singer singing. So what used to do, I'm sure sometimes he used to grab somebody off the street and say, stand in front of that mic and sing something. We used to play the backing track. As long as if somebody's singing, we could do 20 minutes of music, which sometimes would be six titles, and it was 3 minutes, the title on everything. And then they used to come in, and with that track, they used to, this is why we never knew who we were actually recording, they used to go out and find a singer. And, oh, we've got a track for you, and they used to put them on that track and issue it as a record. By which time, of course, they put something else on it, and we didn't know what we were playing on anyway. So until it came sifted back through the grapevine, through the engineers who were saying, you know that stuff you did like 3 months ago, they just put like a VJ program or something. Yeah, you listen to it. But that stuff went on. It's not nice, but that's the industry. Yeah. Yes?
This isn't really a question, it's more of a comment. Referring to when you guys were talking about people not wanting to admit your presence on records and things like that. For what it's worth, and it doesn't put any money in your pocket, there are a lot of fans and players out there who do know who you are and the things that you've done, and to us, you're just as big heroes as the featured vocalists.
Oh, thank you.
Whatever.
It's been very nice of you.
For what it's worth. That's the guy who did, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I do get a lot of emails from people, and I know Andy does as well, you know.
I wish we could put a check for him.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Just those words are enough, thank you.
Something a bit weird about you.
Towards the end of the 60s, as bands began to spend like 3 months, 6 months, a year on the album itself, how did your jobs change, moving from live recording to...
How did what you do change as bands became more kind of focused on spending long hours in the studio?
Well, it's the case that the bands who were making were successful, they could afford, the companies could afford to put them in the studios for a length of time. They didn't get in the studios until they were successful. You know, a group from Liverpool didn't turn up at a recording agency and said, great, we'll put you in the studio for 3 months. They had to have a hit record, and they have to enough income and enough sort of futures, as it were, for the record company to say, go to the farm for 2 months and make an album. It didn't affect us, because we still just had to go in and make a record, because nobody would say to me, you can stay in the studio for 2 months until you get it right. You know, nobody's going to do that. But if a group was making a lot of money, the world was their oyster. It all comes down to finance, you know. That's a good question, yeah. That's right, yeah. Was there somebody there?
Yeah.
Just to follow up to what was said by the show and what I said before, Andy, the new Beatle box set is released like this week, and Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You are both on it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get anything for that?
No.
That is a serious problem, and that is something.
No, because they were booked, they had a residual contract with EMI as a group, and as a session musician, they just got about $20 that day, and that was it. No residuals involved.
And the record companies made a point of not putting our names on the records, because they knew that if the names were on the records, we could claim residuals at a later date, which is happening now, you see, with subsets.
And funnily enough, what happened with...
It sounded like a bitching all the time, isn't it, just financing?
You know, it was known in the business that I had been on the records, you know, but probably it wasn't known until 20 years later, 1982, they they released a 10 what was called 12 inch single, which had both versions of Love Me Do on it and my version of P.S. I Love You. And my name is actually on the back of the record, but it's about this size. And that's the first time in print that they admitted after 20 years.
Yeah, it's just a fact of life, really.
Yeah,
you know, it's,
yeah.
It's,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's strange, sorry. Yeah.
Yes?
You mentioned that you had stopped in the 80s doing session work. What are you doing today? I mean, besides talking.
What am I doing today? Yeah, well, I'm basically teaching pipe band drumming to pipe band. That's what I do. And I'm involved in the pipe band scene, which is quite big, actually. And I also do, in the summer, do judging at Highland Games, Scottish Games, where they have pipe band contests. So I'm going full circle.
And I do composition, actually. I work at the moment, well, I have for the past like 15 years, for American Airlines, basically because of the medical, you know what I mean? It's either $500 being independent or $60 and fly for nothing, working a few hours for American Airlines. So one has to sort of compromise, and you have to take the situation as it comes, you know. But I still play music. I don't play guitar too much, as you might find out. But I do a lot of composition and a lot of stuff. It's, you know, I do okay. But to do the traveling to England and traveling to New York and traveling to Miami and stuff like that, that I do, from my point of view, is great just to hop on a plane, which is one of the things that corporate world offers you. In the past, the corporate world has taken, so now I'm trying to get a bit out of it. It's just a case of you have to go financially. You have to do something. A good question.
Yeah, was he one more question?
What is he doing now?
This guy.
Myself, no, I would have probably gone, but nowadays I would go another route, you know. I would be music, but I don't know that I could. Andy and I were in the right place at the right time and could do what we had to do, you know. But nowadays, what some of the people have to do to do music and to make music, and there's so many people doing it, that it's, I don't think that my age, feeling as I do, I don't think I'd have the energy to do it. But maybe when I was 20, I might have been able to do it. And I hope that everybody who is that age and is studying and don't stop practicing, because there's always that one that's going to make it. You're going to do it, and it's going to be fantastic. And but the orchestras are dwindling, the opportunities for music are dwindling, and it's becoming very specialized in where people can work now. You know, you don't just get a guitar as happened then and go to a club and sing something like happened to Rod Stewart, who used to play guitar for pennies on an underground tube station, and somebody discovered him, and there's Rod Stewart. You know, it's one of those things, can happen today as it can happen then. But myself, no, I think I'd, well, first, what I wish I'd done was I'd have got a degree in business as well as practicing guitar.
What about you, Andy? Would you do it all again?
I think I'd agree with Vic, you know. Yeah, it's just with one hand now, you know, so unless the occasion arose, unless it did come around again, I don't know what I'd really do. I think all just humping all the gear is enough to put you off at this time, at this stage of life, indeed.
It's a different business now. I mean, the guys have got cartage and all that, and there's people running around after them. And people, the guys are so specialized now. You know, the guy will do country western, and that's all he'd do. He'd do heavy metal, and that's all he'd do. And they would be booked and be paid a lot of money for just doing that. But in our day, you had to do everything, otherwise you didn't work. You know, you'd have to come in and play a sort of a Rodriguez guitar concerto or whatever it is, and get it right. And then you'd have to go and sort of strum in a orchestra. You know, this, what you had to do was so varied and so different. But today, as far as I'm aware, people are much more specialized in
yeah,
what they have to do. You know.
Yeah.